Blog Talk Radio. To the Words on Flicks show on eWater Radio, KEWRDB. That's right. Good evening. Welcome to the Words on Flicks show for Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. Movie talk from a fan perspective with me, entertainment journalist, blogger, and movie fan, Janine Coveney. Thank you for tuning in. I think this is going to be an interesting show. The Best Laid Plans of Mice and Men. My original plan for the month of May was to do a drill down on some of the movie world's best known genres, and my plan was to talk about movie westerns, and we will get to that in a minute. I think it's one of the oldest of the Hollywood film genres from even the silent movie days. And we'll get to that in a minute because I wanted to take some time to acknowledge and pay tribute to Academy Award nominated screenwriter and director John Singleton, who unfortunately passed away Monday, April 29th in Los Angeles. He had been in a coma after having a stroke on April 17th, and that news kind of slowly rolled out, and then there was some confusion online as to what his health status actually was, and then his family ultimately made the announcement that they had decided to end life support for him. And he was just 51 years old, and that's relatively young at a time when there's so much health information available, and people are living much longer than previous generations, and we know he was a hard worker and an accomplished man for sure. So I wanted to take this time to pay tribute to him. And I thought, who can I get as a guest on the show who would be a great addition, who could really speak to his legacy? And so I invited Ms. Juliana J. Bolden to the Words on Flicks show. So before I bring her on, I'm going to tell you a little bit about her because I like to make sure that my guests get a full and thorough, as thorough as I can do, you know, because it's hard with Ms. Bolden because she is a multi-hyphenate who has accomplished so much. But I'll give it a try because she deserves it. My sister is a digital media and entertainment executive. Juliana J. Bolden leads the creation of digital projects, social media strategy, and the production of TV, film, digital content for brands like Wells Fargo, the Emmys, AT&T, the NAACP, and NAACP Image Awards, Grey Goose, Blacktree TV. And she served on the 2016 Democratic National Convention Committee Specialty Media Team. Okay, my girl is connected. In 2009, the San Francisco Bay Area native played a key role in building Emmys.com. So this was the Television Academy's very first consumer-facing website, so relatively recently. And she also helped launch the Emmy Publications Video Film Production Division. So she began her television digital career at ABC Family Channel / Disney, working on long and short form programming, including the Power Rangers series, Ms. Bolden holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in communications from San Diego State University, and she is also currently the executive producer and senior entertainment correspondent for Hollywood Post Network Black Tree TV Group. And so, Ms. Juliana, are you there? Welcome, welcome.
Hey, I am so here. Thank you for having me. It's always interesting hearing what you've done told to you by other people. I was like, man, I guess I've been a little busy.
You've been busy, and really, girl, you got the long, long, long bio. I could have, you know, we could have talked half an hour about that, but we're going to move on because for our purposes tonight. Go ahead. What?
I was going to say, none of us have been as busy as John Singleton, God rest him. I can't believe we're having to tribute this brother.
I know. I know it. And he's young. And, to be honest, I had forgotten, and, you know, this is the shame of the modern age when there's so much media and so many people now, so many African-Americans now getting a foot into the game at a much higher rate, that I had the nerve to forget some of the other things that John Singleton had done. And what helped remind me was your story in HollywoodPost.com, titled The Star-Making Record-Setting Journey of John Singleton, which, listeners, you should really check out at HollywoodPost.com. So tell me about having to write that story, and did anything jump out to you as you were kind of summarizing his career?
Yes, actually. The thing that jumped out truly was the fact that he made stars. He was very, very young when he passed the other day, but he was very, very young when he got started. This man, the first thing that jumped out was just how many stars he actually made, from Morris Chestnut to helping to elevate Angela Bassett, and so many more that we'll talk about. But the other thing that jumped out was that the Boys in the Hood script, just one of several films that he would come to be known for, was actually an idea that he put on his USC film school application. A lot of people don't realize when you want to go to film school or, you know, on whatever level, a lot of times you come in with an idea, but how many times would you think that an idea that a student came with would end up being one that goes on to be a classic that ends up in the Library of Congress?
Exactly. That is amazing. And again, what was he, 24, 23, 24 when the Academy Award nomination came through for him for that film?
Think about this. If he's 24 when the nomination came through, generally it takes quite a while for a film to come together, and then the film to be in the theaters, and then to have gained traction, you know, on one side of the green light versus the other. So we're talking about maybe something that he started potentially in his, might have started in his teens, maybe when he was 19. He had been thinking about it for several years. So the gestation period for this idea was far earlier than 24, even though 24 was the age when he got the record setting nomination for director. And I cannot even get used to speaking about this in past tense. This is really difficult.
I understand. Did you get a chance to meet and interview him being on the West Coast?
I had a chance to meet him and be in his presence, say, what's up, how you doing? I was not one of the fortunate few who can call him a close friend. If you spend any amount of time around Los Angeles in this business, chances are you crossed paths with him, you recognized him, you say hi, and he just responds to you like anybody else that you would meet without the pretense, without any kind of pretense, and just seemed in, like the night, you know, just one of the, you know, you could say that someone's like a nice person. That doesn't sound like it has a whole lot to it. But what, when I say that he was connected and interested in uplifting others, all you need to do is just look at all of the when you look at all the actors whom he helped put on, you can also count that he helped put on people behind the camera as well. He was known for giving people chances and uplifting folks and celebrating others.
He really was special because he was really committed to bringing our stories to the screen, and in a very, very realistic way. Like, he wasn't like sanding down the edges necessarily. And, you know, part of the reason why Boys in the Hood was so distinctive was, you know, one, we hadn't really seen that story told quite that way from that area of the country before. And the magic of it is in the script that he wrote, because it all comes through on screen in the performances. If you don't have a strong script, you know, very tightly developed, great, you know, dialogue, that's the bottom line. And like you say, he tapped great performers to come through. I mean, even Lawrence Fishburne, this was far from his first movie. I mean, he'd been in a movie as a teenager, you know, but here he was in an iconic role as a committed Black father, you know, an intelligent, hardworking, you know, and that was kind of even iconic as a father role, you know?
I agree. And to your point, what Boys in the Hood offered from a West Coast perspective was a range of people who were Black that were allowed to just be, you know, on this screen in this universal sort of you know, story, you know, this, the good versus evil on the street, the tension in the home of, you know, what happens when you're trying to shield a child from one from good versus bad influence. And then you had the mother and the father with, you know, the history there of trying to parent together while still dealing with their own personal relationship however they could. That was a very key part of the movie for me, having seen my parents split up and knowing what that felt like, at least, you know, not to get through it, but to be in it at that time was something that I connected with, was watching these two parents trying to co-parent from afar.
And also with that character, their son, in, you know, you're in the hood, he's got a lot going for him, he's intelligent, he's trying to stay off the street, and that's what I related to as well, because the pull of the street is strong, you know, when you're a kid trying to stay on the right path, you don't want to disappoint your parents, you know, they've got all their expectations on you, but then your friends are like, yo, you know, why are you putting all this attention into school books? You know, why don't you hang out more? Why do you have to live by all these rules? So that was something I related to, because I grew up in the South Bronx. And the funny thing about, and of course I was an adult when I saw this movie, but being from the South Bronx, so I'm looking at a movie about, okay, it's the hood, you know, Los Angeles. And I'm like, wait, people talk about living in the hood, but they have houses with lawns. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I grow up in a 22-story building with 10, 15 apartments on every floor. I don't understand, like, this is the hood. That looked like paradise to me. They got palm trees. you know.
Well, I was, you just took the words right out of my mouth. I don't know how many friends I had from the East Coast up in arms about the idea that this was not a hood. A hood does not have palm trees. A hood does not have sunshine and blue sky and all of this beauty. But what happens when you have a hood in California, I would equate the palm trees and the blue sky and the sunshine to, say, what it would be, to you know, and roll with me for a minute here. This analogy might take us off a cliff, but, you know, I'm going to try anyway. Imagine what it's like to live in imagine what it's like to, like, live in Alaska and have daylight, 24 hours of daylight. At some point, you're numb to it, and it loses whatever appeal a person thinks that it would have to just be like living in daylight and sunshine all the time. So when you have this sunshine, blue sky, California resort sort of a climate, all of the things like poverty, pain, betrayal, police brutality, those are things that are able to cut through any kind of, you know, appeal that of the beauty of the palm trees. That's a facade that cracks, because everywhere the pain of police brutality or gang violence and all those sorts of things are going to hit, maybe not the exact same way, but it's going to be enough of a common thread between pockets of impoverished or disenfranchised people to be able to relate to one another, whether they're shoveling snow or dusting off palm trees.
Oh, of course. Of course. And, you know, my comment was a little bit facetious, but it just goes to show you that the commonality of experience, particularly the African-American experience, as you rightly point out, wherever you are, but it's just, you know, the climate is slightly different, but, it is slightly ironic. But to get back to John Singleton and the importance, like, he made films that really mattered and really spoke to our modern day experience, and even with Rosewood, which was historical, a lot of his films, they were painful. You know, they were painful, but in a very real, raw way. Like, I have trouble sitting through Rosewood. I remember seeing it. I think I saw it in New York at a screening, and a lot of the press were invited, and, you know, we knew it was going to be, you know, a little bit rough about a successful black town that was torched by angry whites and based on historical fact. And I wanted to leave. It was just so, like, the violence perpetrated on our people was so raw, I almost couldn't stay in my seat. But that was the purpose of it.
I am completely just over the moon about the recognition that we're able to give to his entire filmography. And one of the things that you pointed out about Rosewood, you know, being the period piece and whatnot, I also want us to get in some commentary about Too Fast, Too Furious, Four Brothers. This man, he was able to go some places that a lot of filmmakers would not be able to on a grand scale, especially a black filmmaker. Or maybe it's actually, that's changing for a lot of black directors now because of him. But the range of stories he was able to direct and tell, I hesitate to say unprecedented, but he is definitely one of the people that created more opportunities for black filmmakers to be taken seriously across all genres. And to be perfectly honest, I think that even up to his passing, Hollywood still is, you know, not the... It's still a tough nut to crack, even for somebody like John, who may not be able to get everything made they want to. Even at his,
right.
even with everything that he was able to accomplish, I sense that there was still not a certain level. You know, he did say that he had fun. He did. He's done what he wanted to do. But are we still able to greenlight every story that we want to tell, and are black directors getting their fair share of work? It doesn't appear that way. But for all of the doors that he has opened and trails that he blazed, we're doing a lot better because of John Singleton. And for that, I absolutely will celebrate this man always in the context of film and even television, because let's not forget Snowfall, which he had co-created for
FX. Right, Snowfall. Mm-hmm. And I understand that I actually haven't seen it, but it was kind of described as a pre-Boys in the Hood, like in terms of its setting and how the storyline develops and how, you know, crack infiltrated those Los Angeles neighborhood. It's sort of like a prequel to Boys in the Hood.
I find it really interesting how the small screen became more important the longer his career went on, and that so many superstar actors and directors and all kinds of talent found their way to the small screen. He was able to jump into that whole, you know, changing of the platform guard, if you will, and become one of the storytellers that told stories over longer periods of time, you know, with Snowfall. With as much as we have to be grateful for with his work with, you know, everything from Four Brothers, Rosewood, like you mentioned, Higher Learning. Gosh, we haven't even talked about Poetic Justice, Janet and Tupac.
I
That's
know.
A whole other conversation.
As prolific as he has been
in film, he was part of this peak TV period that we are currently in, with a significant title on a network that has that is known for doing great, great drama, FX, and I'm thinking about all the people that have asked me over the past few days. Well, what was your favorite John movie? What was your favorite movie? And I don't think that's like asking me what's my favorite fruit, apple or orange. It depends what flavor I'm in the mood for. They're all different. And his vision, I would say, if I just had to pick one, I'll just pick the first one just because it put him on the map and it was such a classic. But the biggest thing that I, you know, could, you know, along with so many other fans, could look back and say is that, wow, we lost him too soon. But man,
he
really packed it in. He packed in such an array of pieces of work that
and just like I said, painting these portraits of sort of personalities we hadn't seen on screen before, and the casting that he did. I mean, just even thinking about Ice Cube with the Doughboy character. You know, and Janet Jackson, we hadn't seen her like that before, and just really like a young girl growing up, female empowerment. She was artistic. She knew what she wanted, and she wouldn't compromise in life. And Baby Boy was sort of like this blazing sort of portrait of, you know, somebody that we all know or, you know, or is in our family, and how is Baby Boy's behavior affecting the family, economics, you know, children, all of this stuff. And it was like holding up a mirror. And some people thought that Baby Boy was too honest and was sort of quote unquote airing our dirty laundry. But I think between Baby Boy and Boys in the Hood, those are my two favorites, actually.
Well, I would go and say that part of the reason for the appeal of those two films is they are hard stories to tell. They aired a lot of dirty laundry, and I would not trust that dirty laundry to be shaken out and put out there for the world by very many people. And John Singleton proved to be a trustworthy teller of stories that were really, really difficult to watch, but essential to us growing in our culture.
Absolutely. So we offer our condolences to his family. We salute his accomplishments. We echo his family, sending a message in the wake of his passing for black men to please, well, not just black men, but all people to really look after their health, but in particular African-American men who may be working very hard under stress, who don't always have time to take care of their health. So make sure that you get checked, get your blood pressure checked, get your diabetes, sugar levels checked, take care
of
yourself.
The family actually mentioned in a, statement that more than 40% of African American men and women deal with high blood pressure to some extent. And I found that figure staggering, but they listed heart.org as a resource, and I think we should all take a visit and see what it has to say and make sure that we take good care of ourselves, because maybe these things like the blood pressure, the heart issues and things like that, they're not always super pronounced. I think that they can be quietly affecting us.
Yes.
So we all have to try to get seen and screened and hopefully live some long, happy and healthier lives. A definite shout out to the loved ones of John Singleton for being so selfless in their mourning and using this period to send a message to everyone else. I thought that was very, that was very telling of the type of people that he came from, for them to be mourning and then showing concern about others.
Absolutely. It shows strength and probably in line with his personality as well, like you say, the people that he came from. And I know that he was, you know, he called himself the first black film brat kicking down doors.
Right.
And like you pointed out, he didn't always get to do everything that he wanted to do, but he was very strong in his opinions. And, you know, he pushed for the things that he wanted to do as he could do them. And, you know, when you look at his filmography, you see how prolific he was. He was basically pushing out projects every two to three years. And I was reading Rolling Stone, Peter Travers, the film critic there. He called John Singleton a cinematic gunfighter, which I thought was interesting. And so in this story that he wrote saluting John Singleton in Rolling Stone, he says that the last time I spoke to Singleton, he compared the movie business to the Wild West, a place where you had to fight to make sure your vision came through on screen. To Singleton, all of his films were Westerns. He even insisted that his go-to fanboy film, Star Wars, was a Western disguised as a space opera, which it is. So that is interesting because John Singleton was a big fan of the Western. He saw a lot of his films as being structured as Westerns. And so that's a nice little segue to tonight's topic, which is the Western film genre. So I am by no means an expert on the Western, but I grew up watching them. My dad loved them. You know, we watched a lot of old movies on TV. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, the Western is kind of a boy's genre. You know, it's not for, you know, it's a white boy genre, really. But the Western has always had great storytelling, big themes, good versus evil. And I saw that the film True Grit with John Wayne was celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And because of, and that the film was also remade in 2009, the Coen brothers remade it. And so that got me thinking because the original. Yeah. Okay. You're probably right. I'm just shuffling my notes over here. But that got me thinking about these Westerns. So I was looking online and I saw a story from a couple of years ago in The Atlantic called How the Western Was Lost and Why It Matters. And essentially the story is about why the reboot of The Lone Ranger, which had Johnny Depp as Tonto, kind of failed at the box office. And, you know, of course it did. But the writer kind of summed up what Westerns mean. So I'll read that. Westerns provide many timeless pleasures, tough guy heroes, action set pieces on horseback, adventures in magnificent landscapes, good triumphing over evil. It's all there already in arguably the first film narrative ever made, The Great Train Robbery. But to discuss Westerns as if they just boiled down to heroic stories of saving the homestead from savages, tracking the bad guy through the wilderness, or finding the treasure in the mountains would be to miss the real meaning of the genre. Westerns have earned their place at the heart of the national culture and American iconography abroad because they've provided a reliable vehicle for filmmakers to explore thorny issues of American history and character. So, Juliana, have you watched many Westerns? Are you a fan at all of the genre, or do you just have individual favorite films from the genre?
Well, I watched a few. My dad was more the Western guy for a lot of the reasons I think you talked about earlier, but I watched enough of them to get a good grasp of the story structure and how other films that might seem to be as far from Westerns as you would think because they're not set on a prairie or you don't see guys in hats on horses. But when it comes down to, you know, those literary, you know, elements of the protagonist and the antagonist and a hero attempting to transform themselves somehow because they have to get from here to there or save this place from that. That is why a person like John Singleton or others would absolutely call like Star Wars, you know, a Western. It's Westerns are like the blues music of the American music scene. You can have your jazz,
okay,
your pop, your soul, your hip hop, whatever. But when you distill each one of those things, everything comes back to good old roots blues. So when you're talking about great storytelling, I would argue that the American Western is the roots blues of all American cinema. And for me specifically, I'm just going to go completely like left. I mean, and there's folks that would be here talking about, you know, not only True Grit, but people talking about any and everything from Clint Eastwood or the things that we might have seen. What was it? Tombstone and whatnot. My favorite, I'm just going to go there. I'm not even sure that I should say it. Django Unchained and Posse. I mean, not that I have to always see black people on the screen. I just said they're great. They're great stories, and they were so entertaining for a person like me that thought Clint Eastwood was, you know, pretty amazing, but wasn't, you know, too emotionally moved by his work because it was more my dad's thing. I kind of connected with those stories just for the reasons that I was coming up at a time when Spike Lee and John Singleton were really just getting started, and it was still a pretty not necessarily new, it was still kind of an exciting thing to see people of color involved in these sorts of movies. To imagine myself, you know, on a prairie or those sorts of things. And mind you have other parts of the country where, say, like, people were going to black rodeos and things like that. But this wasn't a time when social media made images of everything else in the world available to everybody else everywhere else. You follow me?
Exactly. So, and in a lot of films, when you go back to the 1800s and 1800s primarily, when a lot of these Western films were set, who are we going to be primarily, you know, servants, slaves, you know, newly emancipated, poor people. So you don't imagine that, you know, you'll be a cowboy with some agency and some freedom. And so to see that depicted finally on the screen, because that was part of our reality, our historic reality, it is really liberating, and it makes you more interested in the genre, as you say.
Well, yes, that's what makes you go and start to appreciate and dig into a True Grit or, you know, 310 to Yuma. And I feel very, I feel more comfortable enjoying Westerns as an adult than I did as a kid, because, like you mentioned, it seemed like that was a boy's genre. And now, a more educated film fan, it's a genre for it's the genre for everyone. I mean, some of the movies for sake of violence are a little bit over the top for some folks than others, but the essence of, you know, the good versus evil is still going to draw, I think, even a fan that has to cover their eyes because of a little bit too much violence here and there when talking about certain films. Do you have a favorite?
But in terms of, well, I have a couple, but I wanted to go back to True Grit for a minute because I think it was one of the first Westerns that I saw in a movie theater as a young girl in the Bronx. And at that time, I didn't, you know, John Wayne was some crusty old guy. I wasn't really interested in John Wayne per se. But what interested me about True Grit was it wasn't about Rooster Cogburn so much to me. It was about the journey of this young girl. If you know the story, it's about this very headstrong young woman who might be 14 in the story, and she hires him to avenge her, the killer of her father. This man shot her father down, and she is traveling to make arrangements. Like, she's very adult. She has an accountant's mind. She's going to settle accounts, you know, sell her father's horses, get him buried, take care of all this business on her own. She's traveled afar to do this in this town and hire this man. And that's what amazed me, because she had so much agency as she's practically a child. And so that interested me about it, because a lot of Western stories, if there is a young person in it, it's a boy. It's a boy's adventure. You know, he's the one with the guns. He's shooting the arrows. He's going to be riding the range on the horse. And this is about Maddie and how she goes on this incredible adventure. And so True Grit is, of course, it's John Wayne, Glenn Campbell. And one of the things that I like about it is it's adapted from a novel, which I actually read after the Coen Brothers remake. Because the one thing about the Coen Brothers remake, which I think is even greater than the original movie, they stick even closer to the book, because the original John Wayne version has a very happy ending. And in the book and in the Coen Brothers movie, Rooster Cogburn does not survive to fight on another day. And that is depicted. But also the language, okay? So there was a language, and that's part of the whole Western mystique, partner. You know, there's all this Western colorful language that makes it come alive and almost seems like you're totally visiting not just the Wild West, but another planet, you know, because of how they speak. And that the language is really lovingly delivered in the Coen Brothers version. So I really appreciated that. And then the other John Wayne movie that I like and can stand is The Cowboys. from 1972 because it was about a bunch of young boys learning how to drive cattle to market, because at this time all the full-grown men have been killed or are away at war, and this rancher has to drive his cattle to market. So he kind of inveigles all these kids to go on this cattle drive, and that's what interested me, because it's about kids learning, growing up. And it also had Roscoe Lee Brown, who, if you remember Roscoe Lee Brown, he's a very noted black actor from, you know, the 70s, who had a very
Roscoe Lee Brown is a person who is to be exalted at all times. And anyone purports themselves to have any kind of expertise as it relates to Black Hollywood has to know who he is. So for anybody listening, gotta Google Roscoe Lee Brown if you don't know him. And then for Hollywood at large, who sometimes overlooks great Black actors, he is to be noted.
Exactly. His diction was impeccable. His timing was awesome. And so to have this Black character show up in a film was also interesting to me. He played the trail chef, you know, the cookie, you know. But he had a lot of he told tales about distant Africa to these young boys, and so he left them kind of scared of him a little bit, but respectful as well. It's actually a delightful film if you can stand John Wayne, and it has some gritty moments too. So we were talking about the violence of the Wild West at a time when there wasn't a lot of formal law set up in a lot of these pioneer towns, these frontier towns, and sometimes that was the justice. You know, you just, you know, have gun, will travel. And that's what happened. So,
you know,
there is a lot of violence in the cowboys too.
I want to point out something, and we can get into this as much or as little. One interesting thing about Westerns is you've got some Westerns that have been, you know, put out in the 2000s. You've got a few in the 90s. But for some reason, there's nothing like a 19. When I think of a Western, it's like something from the 1950s or the 1960s
mm-hmm.
that has this, like, that it escapes me. There's a very famous music composer that seemed to always pop up doing that Western music. And
Bernstein or, yeah.
Yeah, and
or John Williams.
When it came to that feel of, you know, being out riding a horse and doing these things, I feel like by the time, say, like Unforgiven came out in 92, and then later on we see Django Unchained, we really started to see our Black actors in, you know, having even more agency in these settings. I often wonder how other people received Black actors. Meaning, did they feel that were people seeing what we were seeing was adding to the authenticity of, you know, historically because we were there, but some people may feel like that these were like affirmative action hires in these films and that we were in spaces that we actually weren't supposed to be in, which cracked me up because when we walked out of I walked out of seeing Django Unchained and I heard no less than a few, you know, white fans saying that they enjoyed it, but it wasn't realistic. And I kept my mouth quiet because had I actually told them exactly how realistic it was for, like, you know, the idea that, like, a slave would actually rise up and, you know, take things into their own hands for their own, you know, survival, it's more realistic than some would like to accept.
Exactly. And, you know, there are certain people who still have trouble with the idea of how extreme the brutality was against African Americans and enslaved peoples and against indigenous peoples as well. I mean, the violence and the disease and, you know, the bias and taking advantage of, you know, it was extreme. And people don't like to hear that existed because they want to distance themselves from it. You know, that wasn't me. You know, that wasn't my ancestors. You were there. You personally might not have been there, but this is our country. This is our shared history. And yes, it's uncomfortable. You think it's uncomfortable for you?
Hey, you know? when we were talking about the empowered young woman in True Grit, one of the reasons that movie, you know, really connects for a lot of people is because of that character. But the pervasive experience of women of any color as it relates to those areas and any other area, women were there was violence against women that was accepted as normal. And those norms have changed over time, and we do see a lot of the things that were normal for the grotesque, you know, atrocities that they were. I'm thinking right now of Kerry Washington's character, you know, how she was treated in Django Unchained. But that was a very long, very long journey, say, from I can't recall that very first one that you said, from the great train robbery up to, say, you know, True Grit and No Country for Old Men and Tombstone and all those things. It's just the journey of how women were portrayed and treated. That's a whole essay.
Yes.
That's a whole canon of essays in itself. But also women were the
pedestal on the pedestal as well, and a lot of the violence perpetrated in many of these films were to quote unquote defend a woman's honor, or to, you know, to fight have, you know, to marry her, you know, because women were far and few between, and so, you know, people were gonna die so that somebody could win the fair maid, and which was no different from chivalrous times. And then on the other hand, across the street, you had, you know, the brothel with the dancing girls, you know, the saloon, which is also an iconic image of having, you know, the dancing girl in the Western saloon. So which is it, you know?
Women were open-faced, hit and slapped on film. And at the same times as we were put on those pedestals as damsels in distress, it was a very extreme experience to go back and assess the imagery that women, of like I said, women of any color, let alone women of color, women in film.
Exactly.
I have to, at this point, mentioning the brothels, can we just shout out Westworld? Because the Westworld show was actually shot on a set which used to have productions of some of these old Westerns, and unfortunately it burned down in one of those horrible fires. And in talking about iconic Westerns, the set where Westworld was shot was also the scene where some very iconic Westerns were shot. And I'm really happy, actually, that by the time we're having this conversation right now, I'm drawing a blank. What was shot there, and I'm also drawing a blank, the lovely black actress that was running the brothel there, Thandi Newton.
Oh, Thandi. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
In Westworld, she actually was an empowered female brothel runner that turned that whole image on its head. And for anyone that hasn't seen Westworld, I won't say anything else, but it's definitely worth a worth a watch, and pour a little out for that set that got burned down because of the things that were shot there. You know, let me see if I can look it up really quick. It's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. I remember reading about that because they needed all those rolling hills and those plains, and you know, they had like the western town kind of set up there so they could use it. I think some TV shows were shot out there as well, and so I totally get what you're saying. And to
Paramount Ranch in
Paramount
Ranch in California. Is the name of the ranch, and there was actually another show, Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, another Western TV drama that was filmed there, among other iconic Western films.
Yeah, and so, you know, it can't be replaced. I mean, I guess they could try to rebuild it, but I'm sure it wouldn't look the same, wouldn't have the same character.
Well, I know that in this conversation, we're trying to uplift this genre and dig into Janine's Westerns and things, but can I just go left and, like, shout out Blazing Saddles? Because I know it's not the Western.
Oh, my gosh,
that, it's not the Western. It's not a Western that we're trying to have this, like, highly intellectual conversation and everything. And sometimes I'm the wrong intellectual to bring to a very high-end conversation, because I'm going to just take it, like, right back down and laugh about some stuff. If a person hasn't seen Blazing Saddles and you want to laugh a little bit and see a little bit of that Western iconography and see somebody black in a leading role that gets to carry a gun, I would say check out Blazing Saddles and have a good laugh and enjoy a little bit of the Wild West in a way that probably most Western movie makers didn't intend for the Western to be.
And the great thing about that movie, directed by Mel Brooks, of course, I mean, it is a classic. Just because we are all so totally familiar with all the beats, the tropes, the cliches of the classic Western, when a stranger comes into town to, you know, to settle the score, you know, it just stands everything on its head, you know, from the posse to who it is who's supposed to be in jail to even, you know, Gene.
What color the sheriff's skin is. The sheriff is a what?
Exactly. And he has his own theme, you know, because Count Basie is there to play him on and off, you know, and
I forgot Count Basie was in that movie.
Yes, Count Basie shows up, and you know, the railroad workers are singing Cole Porter songs, and you know, everybody in the town is named Johnson, and you know, and I'm so glad that you brought that up, because it is the anti-Western Western, and it's brilliant.
Oh, I thought you were going to be mad at me, Janine, because I already know you think I'm a little bit, like, out of control as it is, but I just couldn't help myself. We're here to the thing that reminded me about Blazing Saddles, we started talking about all these wonderful things, and then when I started thinking about the things that you were saying about how the women, you know, were put on these pedestals, and the changes that we've seen over the years, I think that Blazing Saddles was one of the places that we can mark in history where we were seen on screen. I would dare say that Blazing Saddles is a very key film that moved the needle, because it made people laugh at racism together in a way that was, I don't think, ever seen before in a film, and it was done in the context of the Western.
Absolutely. It turned everything on its head. And Cleavon Little, he was delightful in it, you know, because he just had so much charm and timing, and you know, he walked up in there and turned all these Western white folks around, and you know, you're right. It was trailblazing, and I believe that he gosh, I am tired tonight. Okay. So I believe that it was Richard Pryor who was supposed to be in that role.
Mm-hmm. I could so see that. I can't imagine anyone doing a better job than Cleavon, but I certainly could see Richard Pryor in that role. It would have been like that Silver Streak era Richard Pryor that we would have been seeing in that role.
Exactly.
That he could have played. He could have played all those beats and everything, but I dare say, I don't mean to be colorist about this, but I feel that that pretty chocolate skin on Cleavon helped to get a point across. It was so stark in contrast to the white people in the in the town that, you know, I feel like a dark chocolate, you know, man. Really stood out more in terms of the optics and drove the point home that were made in the film. You know, not that Richard was like, I mean, Richard wasn't like El DeBarge light, but he was
He wasn't Cleavon. He didn't have the suave demeanor that Cleavon had. So good point. And of course, Madeline Kahn was crazy about him in the movie. So,
she was definitely smitten in a way that was so incredibly funny and incredibly she, as a comedic actress, I can't say enough good things about this lady, because like Bernadette Peters, or Eartha Kitt, she was able to be sexy and funny and funny and sexy, and created so much joy for the women that were seeing this man through her eyes. So shout out to Madeline Kahn, because she was completely over the moon funny in that film. Harvey Korman, so many greats. And to this day, I don't know that I've seen anything funnier, at least within, you know, the context of where that film was going. It definitely stands as one of the funniest films ever committed to a film recording.
And I love Gene Wilder, too. Yeah. So we're down to 2 minutes and 30 seconds to the end of the show. So we had a whole bunch of Western, there's way too many Western movies for us to get to, and so many themes that we could talk about, particularly in terms of Black Westerns, which we touched on just a little bit. And then you have like we didn't even get into really like the whole Clint Eastwood, you know, the Pale Rider and all of that stuff.
But
Once Upon a Time
Cassidy,
in the West.
Magnificent Seven. Charles Bronson, Steve McQueen, who are the other guys that would show up a lot.
Henry
Cassidy
Fonda
and
from way back in the day.
Henry Fonda.
Yeah.
Oxbow Incident.
Mm.
And I think that one of the things, you know, if I'm as a fan of Words on Flick, do you have maybe like a top 5 or 10 or something that maybe you could shout out for some of us who need to catch up on our Westerns and be more into, you know, be better versed in the genre, is what I was trying to say.
Okay. Well, I would start with Once Upon a Time in the West, 1968, from Sergio Leone. It's almost like a overstuffed kind of operatic movie with these beautiful, beautiful set piece, incredible cinematography, and Henry Fonda plays against type as a villain. I would say Dances with Wolves, though some people might have issues with it. I would say look for Thomasine and Bushrod if you can find it, from 1972, Max Julian and Vanetta McGee. See The Oxbow Incident. And see High Noon with Gary Cooper, because it's about one man standing up against violence. Juliana, I really want to thank you for joining me this evening. It's been delightful, and you're very astute in your in your observations. So we're going to have you back again. And y'all tune in next week for, the Words on Flick show. And make sure you're checking out HollywoodPost.com to see more of Juliana J. Bolden's work. Good night, y'all. Thanks again. It's the Words on Flick show. Have a good one. See you next time.